I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more beautiful books of the year is Beautiful Scars, Steeltown Secrets, Mohawk Skywalkers, and The Road Home. Its author is the singer-songwriter Tom Wilson. It's a remarkable book about Mr. Wilson's upbringing in Hamilton. There isn't something quite right. George and Bunny Wilson seem too old to be his parents, and even though they're Irish Quebecois, Tom gets called Indian at school. Bunny's niece Janie, whose father is Mohawk, bears a resemblance. There are moving moments in the book, like Bunny taking records for young Tom, her supporting his love of music. We follow Tom's career into music and Tom having kids of his own. Then at the age of 53, he learns of his true identity. It's also terribly moving and just a loving portrayal of a life and the people around him. Tom Wilson is a three-time Juno Award-winning musician who has written for and recorded songs with, among many others, Sarah McLachlan, A City in Color, Colin James, Lucinda Williams, Mavis Staples, the Rankin Family, and many more. His band Junkhouse scored 11 top 10 hits. Other groups include Blackie and the Rodeo and Lee Harvey Osmond. He is also an artist, showcasing his art in New York, Toronto, Ottawa, and here in Vancouver. This book is published by Doubleday. There is an event Monday, the 4th of December, at the Vancouver Public Library's Central Branch. Our friend Hal Wake will be in conversation with Tom starting at 7:30 p.m. The event is free. Visit writersfest.bc.ca for more information. Tom Wilson lives in Hamilton, but joined me from Toronto last week. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Tom Wilson. Mr. Wilson, good morning.
Good to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. So how long ago was it, Tom, when your friend Dave Bedini asked you if you wanted to write a book and you initially said no?
Well, now I got to think about it because it was only 5 years ago I found out that the life I was living
right.
was a little different. So maybe 2 years after. So
yeah.
it was, let's say, 3 years ago.
Yeah.
I was actually sitting with Dave backstage at the Interstellar Rodeo in Edmonton. We were listening to Gord Downie and hanging out at a picnic table in the backstage area, and we were talking, and we hadn't talked for years. We ended up talking for, it seemed, it must have been hours, and I guess Dave took a lot of what we were talking about back to Penguin Random House and
uh-huh.
said, this guy should write a book, which, by the way, is something that any of us who are chit chatters or storytellers or on stage or on radio or, you know, whatever it is that we're doing, a lot of people say, man, you should write a book.
Yeah.
But I didn't think that opportunity would be coming my way. I never considered writing a book, and I just thought it would be a lot of work, and it was not only a lot of work, but it was dedication. That I didn't know my heart was up to. I found out that I have a very strong heart.
Yeah, and so, I mean, the process of writing it, I mean, you are pouring your heart out in the pages of this book, Beautiful Scars. Does it heal any of the pain that you might have had?
You know, I'll tell you, it's like taking off the bandage and ripping the scab off of a cut. And then letting it re-heal again with clean air all around it, you know.
Yeah.
So there was, I dove pretty deep. There was a lot of anger involved in writing this book. But like most things, once we are able to get away, give our ego a back seat and able to establish that what I was writing about wasn't a hateful thing. It was all about love. It was all about the people around me who loved me and made sure that I had a chance to move forward in my life.
Yeah, it's not a happy book. For people listening to this who haven't picked it up yet, it's not a terribly happy book. There's a lot of darkness in it, but, one reads it incredibly hopeful. I mean, it lifts your spirits at the end of this thing because of what happens. So if you have to ask, if people ask you and you have to tell them what the happiest point is in the book for you, I mean, I can see a couple moments where you and the people around you are genuinely happy.
Uh-huh.
What stands out for you?
Well, happiness is usually just like dots on the map, right?
Mm-hmm.
We go from dot to the next, and in between those dots is usually a lot of crap. You know, the happiest points, my childhood, regardless of how it's, you know, things were a little rough there, but that was one of the happiest times in my life. I mean, when you sit down and write about things like that, you know, it's one thing for me to tell you a story uh-huh. about my parents' kitchen on 162 East 36th Street. It's one thing to talk to you about Bunny Wilson, you know. But when you start writing about it, you get to see the pattern on your mother's dress and smell the food that she's cooking, and you hear the radio, you know, the transistor radio in the kitchen, and you actually start reliving those moments. And I realized just how happy I was in that house as a kid. I started, you know, the birth of both of my kids, you know, my relationship with them. You know, I couldn't be any happier. And outside of the book, you know, after the book ends, the story's still going on.
Yeah.
And I can actually say that the happiest parts of my life are really, you know, in the unprinted, unwritten pages at the end of the book.
Yeah. The thing that stood out for me in the course of reading your book is this idea of timing, that mm-hmm. there is a right time for stuff to happen. So, I mean, you know, there are dark moments in your life. I mean, you don't know who you are or where you come from. You go through drug and alcohol addiction. I mean, very low points in your life. Yet you have to go through all this crap, all the shit, because that's what life is, right? We all have these challenges to overcome. And mm-hmm. and the answers that you get are given to you not when you want them per se, but when you need them. Like for example, you mentioned your childhood. There's a very poignant moment when I guess you're all delivered this hamper at Christmas, and you find mm-hmm. out that you're poor, that you're needy. And you know, it's one thing for a kid to grow up and know this or be told this, but the moment that you find out, it's a beautiful scene. Because you go to school bringing a tin of beans for the needy. And then when you open the hamper, you're looking through this, and you say, hey, that looks like the tin that I brought in, or you know, the same, almost, I don't know if it's the same tin, the same brand. And then you realize at that moment that you are needy, that you are poor. And, I mean, what's that like? I mean, does it take the sting out of it a bit better when there's the right time for these things to come up in one's life?
Well, a couple of answers to this is we never know what's coming at us in life. But you're absolutely right, or I agree with you 100% that things come to us for a reason, and they usually come to us if we don't think it's the right time. It's time for us just to stop and see where we are and look around and see what is being delivered to us. So that's how I've been living my life for a while, and I've had a lot of great gifts come my way. As far as being needy goes, writing that story was a little devastating for me. But when I used to tell that story, and I've told that story to friends, and I've told it to lovers and things, and I always, you know, I actually laugh at it. You know, it's always been a funny story to me. The fact that I brought in some Libby's beans and some Niblet's corn and some Kraft dinner and put it in that Dominion box in my grade one class where the Salvation Army took it. And a couple of days before Christmas, a box of food was delivered to my front door. And when I looked in it, there was can of Libby's beans and some Kraft dinner and, you know, some of the things it was it was hard to write because a lot of the time when I was writing this I was thinking about myself as, you know, that six-year-old boy, you know, or I think it's difficult to write about because you don't necessarily have the same strength that six-year-old boy had.
Yeah.
And I actually look at that kid, and I'm kind of proud of who I was as a child, how resilient I was, and how I was able to accept my conditions, you know, and move forward. I think that maybe my childhood, as happy as it was and as devastating as it is sometimes to read about, that was my best. Some of my greatest assets come from surviving, you know, through that.
Yeah, you're a resourceful kid. I mean, all you want growing up is to write music and play the guitar, but, you know, you guys are so poor that you can't afford one. And then you find out that if you sign up for these lessons at a shop, they'll give you a guitar. And you don't want to ask Buddy and George because they're hard up for the money. And so sign up for these lessons to get this free guitar, and then you realize you need a piece of ID or something, and then you're resourceful in the sense that you borrow it from a kid next door.
Borrowed an ID, basically. I stole the guitar.
Yeah,
I stole the guitar I took an HSR Hamilton Street Railway bus, Upper Sherman down to Gore Park, got off, and I basically stole that guitar because I needed that guitar, and I felt that somehow the universe would be a better place if I had a guitar. I don't know if that rang true. I don't know if I tested those waters properly, but I definitely stole the guitar. It's funny because I told that story at Massey Hall because it was inspired by possibilities, art that brought me possibility. Neil Young's Tonight's Tonight was one of those things. And I told this story part of the ceremony inducting Neil Young into the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame. And I told it was people laughed. People got the humor in it. They got the heartbreak in it. But a couple days later, I got a call from Neil Young who said he's still laughing about the fact that I stole a guitar on an HSR bus, you know. So it's the humor is important. There's a thing that we Catholics in Hamilton used to, a saying that we used to use, still use, called funny trumps kind.
Yeah.
And no matter how devastating the situation or how sad it might be, you know, it's best to usually lead with some kind of joke about it, you know.
Yeah.
And so me being able to tell these stories over the years and joke about my condition and the condition of my household growing up, I think was good therapy for me, you know.
Yeah.
It was, like I say, it made me resilient. It made me able to bounce off those things. And I think that we all need to feel the broken heart that we have in our childhood. And we all have these stories. By the way, I don't try to make myself out to be this is just my story is what I'm trying to say.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
I could hear your story and I could be equally as, it could wrap itself around me the same way this book seems to have wrapped itself around you.
Yeah.
Happily to announce.
Yeah, there's one, I don't know if you read the reviews, but there's one beautiful review I saw this morning where the writer says, you know, yeah, this is a good book people who are interested in music will like it. The general audience will like it because it tells a very good story. But the greatest thing about this book is that your kids, their kids, will find it especially valuable because they know who you are.
Yeah. I've always been wide open. Pretty well, my life has been wide open to my kids.
Yeah.
For better or worse. And I'm happy to report that it's been, I believe, for the better. Most of that pie is better. There's a few pieces of that pie that are pretty dark and devastating for me and my kids. But you know what? We all survived. that together, and the book book illustrates that. But there's nothing in the book that my kids didn't already know.
Yeah. Now, are there people around you who are reading or reading this for the first time and maybe unhappy about what you've written?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you can't. I think the way I've been saying it is that, you know, writing this book is like showing my arse in public, you know.
Yeah.
And you can't stand there with your arse out in public without pulling down a few other people's pants, you know.
Mm.
So I think that I've been fairly loving and respectful to everybody that I write about in this book. I've been calling this a 70,000-word love letter, and the reason is because after I was able to shed off my anger and get down to the story, there's a lot of love in that story.
Yeah.
And that's really what I hold dear about this book.
Yeah. I'm sort of dancing around this because I think people should read this book to find out what's happened in your life. But George and Bunny are when you're growing up, you realize, and unfortunately, you know, kids are such assholes, that they tell you growing up that there's something a little off here, because they're so much older than parents of kids your age are. So you know at an early age that there's something to you and something to your story that you don't know. And when you ask Bunny about it, what does she say?
She says there's secrets about you that I'll take to my grave, which is an odd thing to do for a 4-year-old kid to hear.
Yeah.
It's also an odd thing for a 14-year-old kid to hear. And that was the story, and she was sticking to it. She had her reasons, and that was to protect me. One of them was that she knew that me growing up as a Mohawk on the East Mountain of Hamilton would have been a rough ride. I think that she... I have is basically in her witness protection program.
Uh-huh.
All the relatives that I had had different identities. As an example, my Aunt Isabel, who was close to me, was actually my grandmother. My Uncle John, who was also the chief, one of the chiefs in Ganawage, the reserve outside Montreal, was my grandfather. So I was... These people were in my life. They just had different family titles, you know.
Yeah.
The biggest one, of course, being my cousin Janie.
Right.
Who has always been in my life and who, as I've said, is the matriarch to our family. She's sits at the head of the table for all those Thanksgivings and Christmases and the kids' birthdays. And as I was driving her home one night, I told her that I'd found out that I was adopted, that Mom and Dad, I said, aren't really Mom and Dad. And if you ever have any, you know, if you remember anything from that time and you'd like to tell me, please do. And she turned to me and she said, Tom, I don't know how to tell you this, and I'm sorry, but I'm your mother.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of my journey, because for all of my suspicions and all of my feelings of not fitting in and all of my anxiety about being an outsider and not feeling like I belong anywhere, that was the key turning the lock that opened the door that allowed me to step into a new era of truth and hopefully wisdom.
Yeah, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, it's a damn long, I mean, you're over 50 at this point when you find out the truth, even though you have these suspicions, you have these ideas in your head. Again, it's the timing. It's the right time for you. I mean, if you'd found out earlier, it might have destroyed your life.
I wouldn't have been ready for it.
Yeah.
When I was 53, and a stranger told me that her grandmother was friends with Bunny Wilson, my mother, and then told me that her grandmother was so close with Bunny that she was there the day I was adopted, and that was fairly mind-blowing, I gotta tell you. You know, 53, I was a grandfather. I was solid on the ground. Both my feet were planted, you know, quite firmly on the ground. I knew exactly who I was. I knew who I was to my daughter and my son. I knew who I was to my grandsons. So if without all that love around me, I would have been like a balloon with a kite without a string. I just would have drifted off.
Yeah. Because a lot of your life growing up was unknown, unknowable, a mystery, it must have left a lot of your life unexplained, unfulfilled. Drugs and booze, I mean, that filled that, didn't it? Whether you knew it or not.
Yeah, I suspect. Well, how's this? There's no excuse for the way I acted. But I do know that I was compensating for.
Yeah.
I was trying to fill a giant void that was inside me.
Yeah. Your career in music and everything that happened as a result of that, the good and the bad, Bunny got to see a lot of that. Did you get any sense at all observing her? How she thought about how you turned out.
Bunny loved me. No one's going to love me the way she did. Bunny loved my kids. As far as they were concerned, you know, up until recently, they were basically, she's still grandma.
Yeah.
Even though she was technically, or her real moniker would have been my great aunt.
Mm-hmm.
She gave everything she had for me, and she got to see me dragged through the ditches, and she got to see me, you know, put on some kind of, you know, pedestal, kind of, you know, that what I was doing was actually having really positive results. See me win awards, and got to see me on stages, you know, doing really good things. So she was always ultimately proud of me, and she defended me tooth and nail, no matter what.
Yeah. You're surrounded by a lot of strong women, I noticed. I mean, not only Bunny, Janie, Sandy.
Yeah.
And I'm sure your daughter is a significant person.
She's way up there.
Yeah. There's a lesson in there. I mean, the sort of wisdom and the sort of strength that we guys need to draw upon. I mean, it's right there, isn't it?
Yeah, we can take a lesson from women, especially their dedication and sacrifices that they make for men and their children.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of blessed to have these angels around us. I realize that. I think I've always known that.
Yeah.
And even though I grew up in doubt, I grew up in the shadows, in my own home, I still knew that Bunny was a guiding light, that whether I was she was my real mother or not, I knew that I had somebody, you know, to drag me through into the light.
Yeah, there's a beautiful scene in the book. It's funny and it's touching. It's poignant. You're a kid who wants to, you know, you watch the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. You wanted to do that. You love music. You'd listen to the radio, and she'd bring you these records that she didn't pay for.
Yeah,
it's a funny scene in that because she'd get you something you like, and then something that's not necessarily part of the they're not the same playlist, if you will, to borrow from today's vernacular.
Not the same playlist, and as a result, my listening patterns were all over the place as a kid.
Yeah,
You got to remember, I grew up. She was listening to. We had a record player that she'd pull out once in a while.
Yeah.
She listened to Nat King Cole and Ray Charles and, big band era stuff. But when it came to getting me music, there was moments. I mean, I magnified, you know, those moments when she was stealing records from the Zellers on Upper Sherman and Mohawk, but she'd drive her Austin Mini up there in the morning, and you could just tell that she ran in there and grabbed whatever she could out of the bin, because she'd present me with, you know, Black Sabbath, Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, and the First Captain and Tennille record, right? Make no sense. You know, Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks and Donny Osmond record. You know, it was crazy. It was just kind of, you know, crazy choices. But you know what? It was all, once again, she was giving everything she had to me.
Yeah. I mean,
taking those chances for me. She took a chance of bringing me into her home when I was an infant. She took chances when she was getting me music to hear, you know.
Yeah. You know, as I said, I read that and laughed, and it made my eyes wet. And, you know, everything that you have in terms of your music today, even if it's not something that she would have listened to herself, I mean, it really was planted by her, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the whole book, me talking about my childhood, me talking about the neighbors on my street, I saw the world through Bunny's eyes, right?
Yeah.
I saw the world through Bunny's eyes, and I saw it through the battles that she went through in her life. I also saw it through, you know, the kitchen window that she used to stare out of. You know, she used to do the dishes and spy on the neighbors. So my perception of the neighborhood really came from her sitting up late at night watching the guy across the street that she thought was working for Johnny Papalia in the mafia, right?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Now, you know, do I know 100% that that neighbor was in the mob? No, I don't.
Yeah.
But as far as my perception of it, it was Bunny Wilson, you know? That's what she said it was. And it's funny because I ran into a neighbor who I grew up on my street recently, and I asked her about that character in the book, and she goes, "Oh yeah, he was in the mob for sure."
So Bunny was right.
Maybe Bunny got it right. I don't know.
Yeah. So you're obviously still George and Bunny's son. You're still from Hamilton, but being Mohawk, what does that mean for your life now? Especially since it's not been 10 years since you found out who you really are.
That's right. I've waited this long. I was born a Mohawk. I was a Mohawk baby. It just took 53 years for me to realize that I'm a Mohawk man. That culture is going to come to me when I show it the respect that it deserves. Those things will come to me, you know. And I'm in no rush to, you know, it's not like I'm some Bay Street lawyer who's running out, you know, deciding to get in touch with some kind of spiritual contact, jumping in sweat lodges and burning sage and stuff. I mean, this is not, I'm already a Mohawk. The blood that runs through me is Mohawk, you know. I'm going to show my culture respect. I'm going to learn about it in my time and experience it, and when my culture is ready to embrace me, I'll know it.
Now, so being reborn, and especially at the age that you were, you said a moment ago you were already a grandfather at that point. Does it re-energize you? I mean, do you feel a lot younger than you actually are, say?
No, I didn't really feel a lot younger. In fact, I'm feeling particularly old these days. You know, I got lots of aches and pains, and my brain is tired, and you know. So no, I didn't. It wasn't like there was no fountain of youth involved in any of this. But I'll tell you that the effect that it had on my family, on my kids, you know, who are very eager to know more about this. My daughter has been interested in Indigenous studies. Most of her life, and the art that I've been creating, the visual art that I've been creating, is very similar to Iroquois and Mohawk artists. There's a lot of things that have hovered around our family that have, you know, that made it obvious that once I found out that I truly was a Mohawk, then it answered a lot of questions of things that were hovering around our lives anyways. My children made the drive with me back to Ganawage for the first time in many years, to this time to meet my sister Lynn. And my kids were there. My kids are there front and center. Their interest in it is massive, and their respect. They're honored to be part of the Mohawk world.
Yeah. The book is out there now for people to read, for people to buy, for people to love, like I did.
Yeah.
But you said a moment ago the story isn't finished because you're still living your life.
Right.
One wonders if you'll continue to write, because, as I said, it's a beautiful book.
I didn't want to stop writing.
Yeah.
I actually finished the book. I mean, I was doing rewrites on the book and fixing up things, working with my editor, into August, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Early September, even.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? We were, you know, it's like just like patching it up, you know, questions, making things better. I never wanted to stop writing. I just wanted to keep writing books. It was like when this book ended, I just wanted to keep going. I mean, this is the life that I want to live, is when I finish writing an album, I want to do some painting. When I finish the paintings, I want to go out and play some music. I want to pick up the phone. I want to go to Nashville. I want to be writing with different people. I want to be writing for, you know, so I mean, the book is just another cog in that wheel, you know, just another spoke. And I plan on writing some more. I don't plan on ever stop writing. How's that?
Well, that's good news for me, because, you know, to be honest, when Scott sent me the book, I didn't know who the hell you were.
Uh-huh.
One of the few people in this country who didn't know who Tom Wilson was. And now that I've finished it, man, I feel like I know you. I feel, that this life, is the ups and the downs, and especially the downs, it was worth living, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, life is always worth living, Joe. It's just, you know, sometimes we don't realize that.
Yeah.
But this is, the other thing is that I was as honest, you know, how's this? I was the last man standing in this story.
Yeah.
Bonnie's gone. George is gone. My grandfather, John Lazar, is gone. My grandmother, Isabel Lazar, is gone. Janie, my mother, I drive her for groceries once a week and take her to church when I'm in town. But I'm the last man standing, and I've got to tell the truth, and I got to tell my version of the story the way I remember it.
Uh-huh.
And that's all you got, man. All you got is the truth, and it's amazing how you're able to communicate as an artist when you throw yourself completely out there. So I really have put myself way out there. I haven't restricted myself at all.
Yeah.
And as a result, I'm getting, Joe, I got guys like you saying, I love your book. I get your book. It moved me. So, you know what? It's a great lesson for me right now about this. In my quest to be an artist, there's a great lesson in how truth and honesty is the best communicator.
Yeah. Has Janie read the book?
Not yet.
Yeah.
It's a terrifying thought.
Yeah, yeah. Tom, you've made a fan out of me, and I've started listening to your music too. I mean, it's funny how, it's all here in the pages of this book that this is a life that we all can learn from and take away. Well, yeah, you could take away some laughs from time to time, but you really take away, just how much you learn from the meaning of every moment. And congratulations on this, and continued good luck with it. I really hope a lot of people pick this up, Tom.
Thanks, Joe, and thanks for your time and your interest.
The book is called Beautiful Scars, Steel Town Secrets, Mohawk Skywalkers, and the Road Home. It's published by Doubleday. Its author, Tom Wilson, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.